Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah who called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favour and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus.
So keep that bit of the Bible open. You've also got in the, whatever it's called, the brochure for the weekend, an outline of where we're going, and lots of space there where you might like to make notes. So as I was saying last night, that may ring bells for you. It may make the sprinklers come on for you. It may make the earth quake. Good. Well, good morning. We're going to have a great time in Daniel. Let's look at chapter 1 for this first session this morning. I want to start by asking you the question, who gets your vote? And when asked that question, I'm not thinking about whether you're a Theresa or a Jezza fan, or what you think about Brexit. It wasn't my fault. I didn't vote for it. I'm talking really about the issue of loyalty. I'm thinking about the person, the organization, the system, the thing, the idea, the whatever it is, that when push comes to shove, the thing, the person, the institution, the group, to whom you are ultimately loyal. In other words, when they play the tune, you dance to their music. Now, that is the question that runs all the way through the book of Daniel. Who rules? Who is boss? Who calls the shots? And not in general terms, but for you. Who calls the shots for you? Now, you won't be surprised to know, as this book is in the Bible, that the answer to that question is that God rules. But it's a bit more complicated than that. You see, there are lots of ways of summarizing the storyline of the Bible, to read it as a single story. I'm sure you do understand that the Bible is not just a collection of lots of tales, sort of unrelated bits and bobs, just a shelf full of different books, and you never think that one novel has anything to do with the next novel. They're just entirely different. I'm sure you do know that the Bible tells a single story, and it's not about you. And one way of summarizing the Bible story is that it is basically a story of two cities. And the two cities are Jerusalem and Babylon. Jerusalem is God's holy city. It's where God's people belong. And if you want to see it, you don't get out a map and turn to the page of the Middle East and look to find the bit where there's the dot and next to it the word beginning with J, where the Americans have got their embassy. I'm not talking about that Jerusalem. If we want to see Jerusalem, we need to look up. Jerusalem is not here yet, but it's coming. It's the home that God calls us to. So that's the first city, Jerusalem. And the other city is Babylon, and Babylon is where everybody lives. It's a city in the Bible that represents human depravity. It's a fitting place for people who have kicked God into touch. But Babylon, at the moment, is the place where God's people also live. God's people live here in Babylon, in exile, if you like, far away from Jerusalem. We live here until the new Jerusalem comes. We're aliens and strangers in Babylon, and we can't wait to get home to Jerusalem. Now, as I say that, of course, you will recognize this is not so different for us, is it? Who live in London, God's people, far from our heavenly home, living like strangers, exiles, aliens in a city that largely doesn't acknowledge God. That's the thing that rings bells for you. That's what I was going to say last night. Now, this is where the question of loyalty comes in. We live in Babylon, but if you're a Christian, you belong in Jerusalem. And Babylon is very much all around us. Of course it is. It's where we live. And Jerusalem is away in the future. And currently, if we're honest, it's a bit vague. We know it's more important, much more significant than Babylon, but at the moment it doesn't seem nearly so real because Babylon is here, all around us, pressing in on us. So let me ask the question again. Living here in Babylon, to whom are you most loyal? To which city are you most loyal? Who calls the shots? When they play their tune, whose city's music do you dance to? Now, that is why Daniel's a great book to read. It's going to do us lots of good this weekend. It's going to help all of us to live in Babylon, knowing that we belong in Jerusalem. So, let's get straight into the story of chapter 1. And the first thing to see in chapter 1 is that God rules when things go badly. Now, that is a surprising statement. That even then, when the bottom falls out of whatever, God rules, even then. Look at chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. Oh, all these place names have got different significance now. The king of Babylon comes to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah in Jerusalem, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he, Nebuchadnezzar, brought them back to his land, the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and place the vessels in the treasury of his God. Now, it's very easy to read those verses out, but that is actually a crisis of everything the nation stood for. the nation of Israel. Because God had made the Jews his special people, and his promise to them was, you are going to be a great nation living in a prosperous land. And of course, that's a promise that God kept, as the mighty children of Israel, a nation probably of about 2 million, walked out of Egypt in the book of Exodus, and they walked all the way into a land that God had promised to them. There they are. And we pick up the story now, 1,000 years after the Exodus. And that once united nation has now divided into two. And the northern half of the nation has been threatened by a world superpower, Assyria. Assyria's come and kind of done its bully boy tactics and basically carried off the north into exile. And effectively, that northern half of the kingdom sort of disappears from history. Meanwhile, in the south, this is the bit of that we're now following, this southern half of the nation, this Judah, enjoys a brief reprieve before the next bully comes along, and that is Babylon. And Babylon also takes them into exile. That's what verse 1 is all about. That's the story of verse 1. And as the king of Babylon comes to Jerusalem and carries off the best people, he takes with him into Babylon the kind of top guys, including our Daniel, who at this stage is a teenager, probably, undergraduate student, aged about 14. Yet so much for, in the olden days, they were thick, primitive people. Okay, at uni, about 14. And all the people are going to end up being deported, and the land is going to be destroyed. Now, that's what I mean last night when I said that Daniel is crisis literature, 999 literature, 911 literature. Because the question that is on everybody's mind is, how do we make sense of this, and what on earth is God doing at the moment? Is God any good? I mean, he looks about as powerful as a jelly, doesn't he? Whereas Babylon, the country we've been dragged off to, I mean, we know their gods are pseudo-gods. They're pathetic gods. They're just lumps of wood that somebody's had to go at with a chisel. We know they're lifeless, but that is obviously where the power is with them and their gods. This tyrant regime just pulls on its jackboots, can march in without so much as a by your leave and stamp all over God's people. How on earth can you say that God is in charge? You know, it's a bit like in the movie The Wizard of Oz. I'm going for really contemporary illustrations here. In the movie The Wizard of Oz, when finally Dorothy and her pals get to the end of the Yellow Brick Road and in the Emerald City, and they're all fearful of the great and mighty Oz, and they find out it's just a befuddled old man behind a curtain. You know, he's got a kind of megaphone. Is that what God is like? You know, just all bluff, bluster, but he's just a befuddled old man with no real power hiding behind a curtain. How can you say that God is in charge? Okay, now look at verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Do you get that? God did it. I mean, he's the one who delivered them over. The Lord gave the king of Judah into the hand of the king of Babylon. In other words, this isn't something that happened despite God, against his better judgment. He was ruling no less when his people were in chains. And in fact, this exile was exactly God doing what God had always said he was going to do. He'd promised that, yeah, things would go well for the nation of Israel if they were loyal to God, but if they were disloyal to him, then things would go badly. And they had wandered from him. Yeah, covenant blessing for obedience, but covenant curse for disobedience. And the rest, as they say, is history. This nation, Judah, it was disloyal. God kept saying, come back, turn around, be different, but they didn't. And now, of course, God had done what he'd said he would do. God did it. Exile. They're carried away from the place of blessing. So what seemed like an absolute disaster, that was God keeping his promises. That's exactly why they get taken into exile. That's why they're punished, because God still rules. But I want you to think how this would feel to them. what it feels like to be in that situation. Now, actually, we know exactly what it felt like because they wrote it down in some of the Psalms. You know, when we were in exile, we felt like, well, all we could do was cry. There's nothing else we could do. We just hung up our guitars on the nearest tree. We couldn't sing. The Babylonian captors mocked us. They said, go on, sing us one of your happy worship songs. But we couldn't. All we could do was cry, says Psalm 137. An older preacher that I really admire once said this: the Bible is written to convince us that God is in charge, because we don't really believe he is. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that God is in charge, that he rules, when the bottom drops out of your world. So let me ask you, do you think that God is less in charge when things are tough, when some absolute disaster happens to you, some relationship falls apart and there's bad feeling and hurt, or when your plans for this stage of your life or the next stage of your life just don't seem to work out, or when your computer crashes and you lose all this morning's work? And yet, honestly, it can be something as trivial as that, can't it? When that happens, and we think, ah, God, why did you do that? You know, it can be trivial in the big scheme of things, but somehow we feel as if God has failed us. If I'm going to blame anybody, I might as well blame him. But when things go swimmingly, when everything's going well, we think God is very powerful then. We're so shallow, aren't we? God rules, full stop. If things go badly for us, that's not because God has somehow lost some of his magic powers. And if things go well for us, it's not because he's suddenly found them again. Behind these troop movements on the ground, God is moving nations and his purposes onwards. God rules. And he rules when things go badly. An example of this that's often quoted is what happened in China in the early 1950s. Let me just make it absolutely clear. This is long before I was born. But the China Inland Mission that had been established by Hudson Taylor had missionaries working in China. Then the Maoist regime basically kicked out all the Western missionaries. This had an impact on our family because my dad was thinking he was going to be a missionary to China with the China Inland Mission. And I understand that what happened is basically this sent shockwaves through the Christian world in the West. What on earth is going on? How can it be that we believe in a God who wants mission, and we believe in a God who's all-powerful. How can he kick out, how can he allow the missionaries to be kicked out of China completely? Now, of course, we see it very differently now, because we now know there's Christian revival going on in China. If you compare the average annual growth rate, is extraordinary. I saw a Christian pastor on Newsnight a couple of years ago saying that he thought China could be a Christian nation. Extraordinary, isn't it? But whether or not we get the happy ending, God is still in charge, and was in charge in the 1950s. It's actually the same in Afghanistan. 99% of the nation is Muslim. There's a tiny handful of Christians virtually wiped out. Christian evangelism is prevented. God still rules. This man that I met in Zanzibar, he's a secret believer. He had been a high-up cleric, Muslim cleric, and converted to Christianity. He was tried, I think, under Sharia law, found guilty, and the punishment was that he was beaten up. His back was broken, the whole of his right side is paralyzed. He can only get round now on a hand bike, you know, like this, to move around. He can never have a house. He can never have a job. He can't ever go to church. He has to live in the shadows. If he was found, he'd be killed. And I said to him, how's it going? And he said, well, I'm still standing firm. God is keeping me. God still rules. The church is still there in Zanzibar. It's tiny. By the way, as far as I know, there are no conservative evangelicals on Zanzibar. Not one. Pentecostals are there witnessing. Shame on us. God rules then when things go badly. Second thing, God rules when things go well. Look down to verse 3. Then the king of Babylon commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food the king drank, the wine he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king, in other words, enter the king's service. Now, what's going on? Well, obviously, there's a bit of clever political maneuvering. So he's kind of identified the brightest and best of the nation that he's swallowed up, and he's indoctrinating these potential leaders at undergraduate level in his private university, fill their brains with all things Babylonian. Moulding these potential rebels, I suppose, into dependence. Clever. But I think there's greater significance as well, that what is going on here, what Nebuchadnezzar, this king of Babylon, is doing, is attempting to order the world with Babylon and its king Nebuchadnezzar at the centre of it. One world with one language, one social policy, one common bond of education, one national curriculum, imposing unity. And I think that the names that they get given in verses 6 and 7 are part of that imposing a new identity. All of their names establish a new relationship with Babylon. The names that they had link them to Israel's God. The names they get given link them to Babylon's God, and therefore to Babylon's king. See what's going on here? It's an attempt to reorder the world with Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar at the center. So do you see what's going on here? This is a challenger to God. This is somebody saying, I'm going to be king of the world. Come around me. And yet, God is still ruling and ruling as much as ever when that goes on. You see, look down to verse 9. After Daniel and his friends decide that they're not going to eat the royal food and wine, we're told in verse 9 that God affects the official to show favor towards Daniel. But look how that verse 9 is worded. Do you see what it says? God makes this happen, and it uses the same word in verse 9 as is used in verse 2. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the eyes of this eunuch. Look down to verse 17. It's just the same thing again. As for these four youths, God gave them learning, knowledge, understanding, even in pagan literature and culture. Notice again, it's God who gives them this. And given what it says in verse 9 and verse 17, those two examples we've just looked at, I presume it's exactly the same thing going on in verse 15. You know, there's stuff every week in the paper about diet, isn't there? You know, if we eat, I don't know, whatever the latest thing is, toast, we'll live shorter lives or whatever. Or longer, I can't remember. Am I allowed to eat toast or not? Probably not, it's a carb. No, don't eat carb. Maybe it is just the simpler diet is more healthy. But the theme of the chapter is that God has done it. So I take it that he's done this too. He rules over that, diet as well. So you've got it, God rules, so a government official shows favour. Verse 9. God rules when we're healthy. Verse 15. God rules when we pass exams at a secular university in secular studies. Verse 17. Now, this is important because one of the images that there is in Daniel, one of the pictures that he gets in one of the weird dreams that we'll come to later, is he sees this Babylonian empire, this reign of Nebuchadnezzar, as a huge spreading tree. We used to live in Nottingham until a couple of years ago, and we had a tree. This isn't actually a tree, but it was just like this, this massive copper beech at the end of our drive in Cloud House. I know that sounds a little ostentatious. We lived on a farm, okay. the one in Daniel, you could see from the ends of the earth. So it's a bit of a bigger tree than the one that we had in Nottingham. And in this dream, the thing is that the birds of the air build their nests in this huge tree so that they can be safe and provided for. And Nebuchadnezzar has to come to realize that, yes, he and his kingdom is like the tree, but the greatness of the tree actually belongs to God. His kingdom is a great tree because God made it so. But you get the point for Daniel that God's people in exile found themselves not like castaways suffering terrible deprivation, but found themselves like birds finding safety in a huge empire. They're resting in the branches of Babylon. The Jews are actually sharing in pagan prosperity. And when God sent them there, he told them that they were going to be there for a while. So he said, it's okay for you to settle down there. Build houses, don't just live in tents. It's worth doing that. You're going to be there for long enough. Plant gardens with perennials. You know, it's worth it because you'll see the plants come up every year. Have families rather than think, oh, we won't have kids till we get back home. Care about, pray for the welfare of Babylon. Now, I take it then that it's not wrong for Christians who belong in Jerusalem but who live in Babylon. It's not wrong for Christians to care about the economy of our country or the prosperity of London or how the company we are working for is faring or the degree we might get. Because God's sovereign rule extends to all this and more. His rule isn't limited. Will you get it clear in our minds that God's rule isn't limited to what we might call religious stuff? You know, his rule seeps into every bit of your life. There's no bit of your life you can say, well, that's kind of just me. It's not really God's area. No, it is God's area. So tonight, when you're brushing your hair, and you look down kind of sadly at the hairs that are on the brush. Some of us, I can see, will be looking more sadly than others. Some of us won't, there won't be any hairs on the brush because there are no hairs to remove. The Bible says not only does God know how many hairs are on the brush and how many hairs remain in your head, but they only got from the head to the brush on his say-so. Now, if God's rule extends to that, you think there's some bit of the world it doesn't extend to? See, this anti-God pagan was not outside the rule of God. God was still on the throne, and Nebuchadnezzar's prosperity was actually God's provision for him and for his people who were nesting there. Extraordinary thing. Part of God providing care for his people was by them living in an alien pagan nation. So his third thing, which is the kind of implication of that, if God rules, live as exiles. Because he rules, live as exiles. And that's why I think this stand of Daniel and his three friends, that's what's significant here as they refuse to eat royal food and wine. Because this is the point when they say whose side they are on. They go public. They say courageously and brazenly, but humbly, they say they serve a higher king. And they model what it means for us today to live as citizens of Jerusalem who are in exile in Babylon. What it means for us. And the message is, settle down. But don't settle down. Now the key is down in verse 8, where you see that Daniel resolved that he wouldn't defile himself with the king's food. So for Daniel and his friends to eat from the king's table would be defilement. Now, the message here in Daniel chapter 1 is not be a vegetarian. Bad luck, veggies. There may be good reasons to be a veggie, but you don't find them here in Daniel 1. Actually, there are no good reasons to be a veggie. It is clear elsewhere in the story that Daniel and his friends do eat rich food and wine. Nor, I think, is this to do with Jewish kosher laws. In other words, they're being asked to eat food that would be unclean in their religion. Nor do I think it is to do with the fact that the food would almost certainly have been connected to idol worship. It could have been those things, but I don't think so. I think it is that this food is much more like a business lunch. You know, the kind of lunch where food is all about buttering up the client or cementing the deal. You've done the morning of negotiation and you end the negotiations, you sign the document, you go out for lunch. Just like it is in the city today. In other words, what's going on here, that to eat food from the king's table would be a sign of total dependence on the king, of total loyalty to him. It would be saying, we need him for food, we need him for everything. We've got to be loyal to him because he's our one and only provider. And as far as Daniel was concerned, that was the point to say no. This was the moment where the citizens of Jerusalem made it clear that there were limits to their loyalty to Babylon because they were citizens of Jerusalem. Actually, some people have suggested that verse 7 and verse 8 should be kept very closely together because it doesn't come out in our translations, but the same word is used in both verses. So in verse 7, when these Babylonians tried to rebrand the guys, to give them, if you like, Babylonian gods tattoos, which is effectively what they're doing by renaming them. What they were doing, and the word actually is, set upon them. They tried to set upon them their anti-God identity. This is the point in verse 8 where Daniel and his friends, same word, set upon their hearts a greater loyalty to the Lord. In other words, this is the point where they'd say, right, no to total loyalty, because our loyalty to God matters more. It's worth asking, isn't it, if Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego hadn't learnt here to say no, would they have been able in their middle age to say no when they're expected to fall down in front of the king's idol in chapter 3? It's worth asking, isn't it, whether if Daniel hadn't learnt here to say no as an undergraduate, mid-teens, could he have made the stand as an 80-something-year-old when he was faced with the lion's den in chapter 6? All kinds of people may claim allegiance from us as this rival lord to our God who rules. It can be team spirit. It can be company loyalty. It can be the person in the office whose approval we want. It can be big formal institutions. It can be peer group pressure. Babylon is full of people who expect our loyalty. But if we belong to God, there is a point to say no to food from the king's table. And let me just say, if you're here this weekend as somebody who isn't a Christian, you need to know that at the heart of becoming a Christian is a matter of changing allegiance. It's saying, I am going to serve a new Lord, just like Lizzie was saying. The point at which you say, the Lord in my life is now going to be Jesus. A point at which we graciously but boldly make the stand, here and no further. My first loyalty is to God. I'm going to nail my colours to the mast. I'm a Christian. I want you to know that this culture and all it stands for, this is not my home. I've got another home I'm heading to. Now, maybe that the rubber hits the road on that with a kind of big formal institution. So, for example, it may be that church leaders have to say to the leaders of church denominations, we respect you, we pray for you, we submit to your leadership, but there may come a point where we have to say no to bishops' reports as they drift further and further from the Bible because God rules and not General Synod. There could be a point for the undergraduate to say in the science seminar, I won't simply adopt all that accidentalism that your theories of origins assume. Or to say in the arts faculty, I believe that God has spoken words and therefore words mean something. Texts do have meaning. A point to say at school, to mates at school, I won't join in with your weekend drinking culture. A point to say to the boss at work, Wednesday night is my Bible study night at church. I work late 4 nights a week, but not Wednesday. Sorry, but Bible study comes first. I'm going to go to that. I have to be at that. I can think of a man in a church I worked in who became a Christian. His wife wasn't a Christian, but he became a Christian. He worked for the council, and his job was to draw up contracts for council employees, people who swept the streets, bin men and so on. People who he described as they're not all blessed with the greatest intelligence. His job was to draw up contracts that hid in the small print lots of clauses that could be used to sack people if the council changed its mind about somebody. And when he became a Christian, he went to his boss and said, I'm not prepared to do that anymore as a Christian. I think that's dishonest, and I won't be part of it. So he was moved sideways. You think, well, that's a tough thing to do. No, I haven't got to the tough bit. The tough bit was where he went home to his non-Christian wife and told her that's what he'd done. That was where he was making the stand. And her reaction was, you've done what? Are you crazy? You've got 3 children. What do you think you're doing? No, I have a higher loyalty to the King of Kings. My first loyalty is to him above you, my darling wife. That's a tough call. Now, I think that Daniel 1 is quite tricky to apply, because it's quite difficult to work out what is the point at which they say no. Why do they say no at that point? I would say no when the names come along. But I suppose you can't stop people can call you whatever they like, can't they? I mean, we could call Sam whatever we like this weekend, couldn't we? Let's call him Prince Harry for the whole weekend. I mean, he can't stop us, can he? And maybe the idea here is not so much what it is or they make the stand over, but the fact that they make a stand at all. In other words, there is a point where they make it clear to the powers that be, I have a higher loyalty to God. And maybe the fact that we make the stand is more important than the thing we make the stand over. And if you don't make a stand now, then what makes you think you'll make a stand when the gorgeous non-Christian hunk comes along and you want to marry him? If you don't make the stand now, what makes you think you will make the stand when your career masters treat you more and more like a slave who thinks that you've sold everything to serve them? If you don't make a stand now, what makes you think you'll make a stand when prosperity sedates you and soothes you and rubs away every bit of Christian distinctiveness? See, it may be something quite small, as small seeming as what you eat from the buffet. But it matters that we make the stand and make it clear who is the Lord we serve. We must express our higher loyalty to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, where we make clearly God rules and I'm on his side. And because he rules, we know that one day we will rule alongside him. And that's where I think the last verse of the chapter fits in. Let's have a little look at that. It's a crushing statement which tells us that Daniel was there in the court until the first year of King Cyrus. And it's crushing statement because remember, Nebuchadnezzar is a tyrant. He's establishing world rule. He's enforcing world domination. And yet, according to verse 21, Daniel outlasted him. And Daniel outlasted his son. And Daniel outlasted the entire Babylonian dynasty, and he was there until the next dynasty, the Persian dynasty, came along. Now, the point to learn here is not that Christians will always keep their jobs, nor that Christians will always do well, nor that Christians will always outlast their swine of a boss. I think verse 21 is only saying this is what happened here. But it is, I think, a picture of a larger truth that the book will enlarge upon. Because God rules, those who side with him will one day rule too. Not necessarily now, because Christians are going to continue to be trodden on. God's people are in this book, in our day, are in chains. But in the future world, where things are put to right, God's people will turn out to be the winning side. They will be the people who win the cup. Contemporary illustration slipped in. They will be the battle victors. Christians will be the forever prosperous, blessed ones. And that is why we live as exiles. We Christians do too. We are citizens of heaven. That's our citizenship. Philippians chapter 3. Our citizenship is in heaven. So we're sojourners here. We're just staying for a short while on earth. You know, our time on earth is like a weekend break in a hotel in Watford. I mean, it's nice, don't get me wrong. But you wouldn't want to live here, would you? You got that view of your life on earth? It's just like a weekend in a hotel in Watford. It's about as glamorous as that. We're aliens, we're strangers, we're exiles. That's what 1 Peter describes us as. You can't wait to get home on Sunday afternoon. It'd be nice to have my own bed, wouldn't it? I mean, I like having an ensuite, I like having a telly at the end of the bed, but it'd be nice to have my own bed. My own duvet is just the right thickness. My pillows are just right. Can't wait to get home. And I've got a wife there as well, in that bed. And you've got a teddy here. It's not the same. We know who rules even over this world. Now, whether we feel things are terrible for us or whether we're enjoying every blessing of Babylon at the moment, we know who rules. And because we know who rules, the wise thing is to throw in our lot with him, isn't it? To live for him and not to fear those who might oppose us, but to fear him who will be the victor and will reign over all things forever and ever. Let's pray together. Almighty, sovereign God of heaven and earth, you rule. You rule over every part of this universe. You rule over every part of our solar system. You rule over every part of planet Earth. You rule over every part of Britain and you rule over every part of our lives. There is no bit of our world or our life where it's inappropriate to say that you rule, for you rule everywhere. There's no corner of our lives that is private, that is our bit and not your bit. You rule when things go swimmingly well in our lives and you rule when things are terrible. You never weaken in your ability and your might and your power. Your sovereignty is never diminished or lessened. It always covers everything. Lord, please would you persuade us from the Bible that you rule. Because if we're honest, we don't really believe it. And we need the truth that your word tells us so that you convince us of what is actually the case. Lord, Babylon is pressing in on us all the time. It's so real, so invasive, so demanding. That expectation that we be loyal to this world is so everywhere. Lord, please would you help us to so believe that you rule that we live as exiles here. Please help us to get a right perspective on life here. Please help us to long for Jerusalem. Please help us in all our settling down in Babylon, not actually to settle down and think this is it. Please would you help us, please give us strength, please give us the determination, the conviction that you rule, so that we are able to make it clear that we belong to you, that we're loyal to you, our higher loyalty is to you. Please help each of us as we've been thinking about where the rubber might hit the road for us. Please would you help us not just to think of what that might be for us, but actually to be determined to make that stand and make it clear to whoever that we belong to you. Thank you so much for your word to us today. There's nowhere else in the world that tells us this other than you speaking to us through your word. So may we believe it, hold fast to it, may we order our lives in the light of this truth that you rule. In Jesus' name, amen.